You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the meeting grounds for spirituality and society, religion and culture.
Greetings, everyone. I hope you enjoyed your morning tea, and you're looking forward to this morning's elective just as much as I am. My name's Ian Brown, from the Redcliffe area, just north of Brisbane. I've been given the honour of introducing the speaker for this morning's elective, Reverend Bob McPherson. Are you you, or Unitarian Universalist? Over the last couple of millennia, a huge amount has been written about the extraordinary feature this rather extraordinary feature of Christianity, the Holy Trinity, Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, or Holy Spirit, which has served to keep theologians employed, preachers challenged, and, dare I say it, pew sitters entirely bewildered. The idea of a simpler imagining of God, which is the basis of Unitarianism, has, to me, a definite appeal. Now, Rob was raised and educated a Catholic in the US and fleetingly considered training for priesthood after being successfully engaged in various occupations including acting, corporate training, teaching and administration. He joined the Unitarian Church in 1992 and he came to the Adelaide suburb of Norwood to the Unitarian Church there as a lay preacher in 1999 and a decade later commenced ministerial training in the UK. It's a bit of a polymath, but Rob holds a postgraduate diploma in contextual theology, as well as a BA in English, an MLA in philosophy, both with high honours, and a certificate of acting from the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. It's probably a pretty good thing to have if you're a minister of the church. His Norwood Church is thriving. Audience attendances having trebled in the period since his arrival there. The church runs a multi-faith speakers program and has instituted a new series of religious education programs, which are obviously very popular. And when delving into a bit into Rob's background, I came across the February edition of the Adelaide Unitarian, and you can look it up online. And it has actually quite a lot, a great selection of many of his addresses. And one of them that caught my eye particularly was entitled "How Do You of Creeds and Credos?" And the interesting thing to me was that it was accompanied with the musical offerings by a group called Schrodinger's Cats. For those of you who are interested in quantum physics, you might get the connection there. So Rob's talk promises to complement those of several of our previous speakers over the last couple of days in a quest for a better understanding of what's meant by that deceptively simple term spirituality and what it means particularly from a Unitarian Universalist perspective. So please join me in warmly welcoming Rob.
Thank you Ian for that lovely introduction. Any doubt that like nothing ever online about you can be hidden, that's one of them. And thank you organizers for the broad-mindedness you're showing in inviting us to this thing. And I explained it to my congregation like this. It's a progressive Christian conference. Why are you going to a progressive Christian conference? Family. I have my father's DNA, but I'm not my father. In the same way, the Unitarians are fully shaped by the DNA of their Judeo-Christian background, but not strictly Christian in any sense that, we're not part of the National Council of Churches in the UK, for example, and so on. So we're not, considered that. But for 5 years, as Ben was saying, I've been the lone full-time minister of a church of around 125 souls in Adelaide. There it is. like all Unitarian churches, it's an independent, self-governed, not-for-profit institution. It's been around since 1854. Not that building, obviously. That's a fabulous 70s piece of architecture. We originally started with a neo-Gothic monstrosity in the CBD that was a forced sale to the city, which is good because the salt damp and the white ants were deconstructing it anyway, which is ironic, but ministry was a late life career change for me, and so this is my first, and it's possibly my last ministry. This might be the last thing I do as a, in my working life. So I'm still new to it, and so therefore still a learner. And though my focus has had to be somewhat narrow, not to say parochial, for that group, since we Unitarians don't have an institutional Orthodox liturgy, and we've been unhitched from the lectionary or indeed any one scriptural source for many decades now, what that means is that most of my working hours over that time, that 5 years, have been spent finding my own voice in that context by planning, composing, and delivering worship material, which is designed to induce, through the manipulation of symbols, some sort of spiritual experience, or at least awareness, in that congregation. What do I mean by spiritual experience? Look, if Diana Butler Bass isn't sure, I'm not sure that I have a cut-through definition of spiritual, but I know it when I see it, and you do too. It's a bit like what the judge said trying the pornography case. I can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it. I don't know what spiritual means in any definitive way, but I sure know a spiritual experience when I see somebody having one. My point is, I've tuned my instrument on speaking of matters of the spirit in a rather particular way to a rather particular, not to say eccentric, choir, and that choir isn't you at all. And what I've got to share might not be suited to a quasi-academic setting like this either, but here goes. So that's the context I'm coming from. In that context, we have, as a church, experienced sustained growth for 4 years now, about 30 to 40%. Not counting the natural attrition of mortality. Much of that growth has been millennial. Most of it is healthily spiritually engaged. So, although I can't define it to you, there must be something about our approach to spiritual life that must be going right. So I want to offer you some thoughts about that today. I'm not sure that I know these are the ones, but there's something's happening, and it's bigger than me, certainly. I'm not sure how much you already do or don't know about what Unitarian Universalism or Unitarianism is, because I'm going to use Unitarian for short because it's a mouthful, Unitarian Universalism. So I'm just going to use Unitarian for short. I'm not sure how much you do or don't know about that, the whatness of it, so I don't know how much not knowing there may be to fill in, like, for example, the person you think of is American, but in fact it's, you know, from somewhere else, or how many preconceptions there might be to unpack. But you're here. So that means you at least Googled it, right? Or you go into some mental Rolodex to pluck out something you heard or read once upon a time. Or maybe you wandered into the wrong room, but look, you might as well stay, because given the mismatched situation, this could be a train wreck. And what fun that would be! Something to talk about over coffee later. So look, let's accept, but not dwell on the fact that there will be significant differences between Unitarianism and even the most progressive of Christianities. So therefore, some things in this presentation may just not make any sense to you. And if there are things that don't make sense to you, I'll trust the use of the Q&A time we have to help make things clearer, if I can. So assuming you know a little of what Unitarianism is, I'm going to be talking today about how, not the what, but the how we do spirituality. Not the what, but the how. The normal caveat here is to say that it is impossible in our movement to talk about a cohesive we at all, all of whom share a common approach to matters of the Spirit. Our congregations are free to do things as the Spirit moves them. There is equal freedom of pulpit and pew, and thus no one authority from on high speaks for the movement as a whole. And even if they did, they'd be wrong, probably. No one could say anything that's going to be unerringly true for the whole movement. We are not homogenous. I think you really need to keep that in mind. We are not homogenous, and we're trying to not be homogenous. This condition of radical freedom of the pulpit and the pew has been largely true since our germination moment, the liberal religious revelation that was the Edict of Torda in 1568, which is, in every place the preacher shall preach and explain the gospel, each according to his understanding of it. And if the congregation like it, well, if not, no one shall compel them, for their souls would not be satisfied. But they shall be permitted to keep a preacher whose teaching they approve. Therefore, none shall abuse the preachers. No one shall be reviled for his religion by anyone. And it is not permitted that anyone should threaten anyone else by imprisonment or by removal from his post for his teaching. For faith is the gift of God. So that statement began a reign of religious freedom in Hungary that lasted 25 years. At a time when Europeans were butchering each other over various doctrinal disagreements, basically those churches agreed freedom was a condition of God. As per Corinthians, ubi spiritus domini ibi libertas, where the spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. That is the motto of the college I studied at in the UK, Unitarian College. And this suggests, does it not, a rather libertarian approach to religion, and thus encourages individual revelation, and thus a diversity of approaches to the spiritual life. So, nothing I or anyone says about a Unitarian approach to spirituality is true for every Unitarian. There is no Unitarian spirituality. There are Unitarian spiritualities. Thank you. That's it. Questions? Not till today. Today, since there are no or few Unitarians watching, I'm going to say things that I think are generally true about spirituality for everybody calling themselves Unitarians. I'm going to try and stand well back from it, without running the risk here of being eviscerated for doing this over coffee and biscuits. What an opportunity this is. Thank you, conference organizers. Now look, educators know the best way to help people better understand any new idea is by using a very specific image or some concrete experience. So let's play a simple game. This is one of those games from Theater 101. Very basic stuff. Very basic stuff. There's no way to get it wrong. Anybody can do it, but just because something's simple doesn't mean there's nothing to understand. So if you wouldn't mind, if you are able, stand and let's look spread out. Stay put, and I'm going to include you.
That's fine.
Just spread yourself around somewhere where you can see other people in the group, not just look at me. There you go. Now there is one and only one rule to this game. The simple first year, first semester, first week theater game. The one rule is you must not speak. This drives Unitarians crazy. but you can't. You can gesture. You can move. In fact, you'll have to, probably. You can make noises. You cannot utter words. We clear? Good. Well done, y'all. Nice break from the talk at the conference, for me, at least. It's the ball game. We call it the ball game. And there are a few initial observations we can make about that exercise, which I'm using as a kind of objective correlative or analogy to our approach to the spiritual. The ball's appearance was probably imagined differently by every single individual in the room. I mean, for me, the ball started out as kind of a reddish leather, like a basketball sort of thing, but also became a stripy beach ball at some point, a yellow fuzzy tennis ball, there was a cricket ball, there was a ball made of God knows what that stuck to the board. So, in your own perception of it, you would have to agree that since there are so many different people in the room, everybody would have perceived it slightly differently. And the ball's appearance, what you saw, could change as you played. Also, the ball's heft and buoyancy was responded to slightly differently by every individual. Everybody caught it and threw it differently with a different sense of its physics. And those physics could change through the exercise. the code we were playing could change. The ball code. It was alternatively beach ball, volleyball, soccer ball, baseball, basketball, I don't know what ball, dodgeball. Somebody was playing. That's my favorite thing. Here it comes. There it is. Yep. Not accepting the offer. Most importantly, you know, I mean, an absolutely general skeptic will say, there's nothing there. Oh, yeah? There was something there that organized all our experience, and we responded to it differently. Just because you can't see something doesn't mean there's nothing there. So a little bit of faith for y'all. And wasn't it not a little bit fun even just to watch? We forget that matters of spirituality should also be about joy, too, and not just stuffily solemn all the time. So there's no prizes for guessing this. The ball game is an analogy for our approach to the spiritual. The ball, invisible but oh so there, stands in for God, what Val Webb calls the great something more, the ineffable mystery in which we live, move, and have our being, in which we keep effing, as Don Cupid said, but all our linguistic symbols fail to capture it fully. The ball game is an analogy of how we approach the how, the something more, when we're at our best. It was pluralistic. That is, people could do it the way they wanted to. And there was no limit to that. It was generous. It was about generosity. It was about making offers and accepting offers or not, or failing to make offers, and so on. And obviously an act of creative imagination. You needed to fill in the blanks of the thing with your creative imagination. This is us. I suggest to you our spirituality when it's at its best. These three things. Pluralistic, generous, and imaginative. And the field of play was grounded in experience. What you actually did or didn't do in response to the mysterious object coming at you. And it was a level playing field. It was open to everyone to play as and how they wished. It was pretty egalitarian. So how does a free, heterodox approach to the something more play out in our church practices? Do we play the ball game every week? Of course not. It's good to do every once in a while after you've had an influx of new people, but you wouldn't do it every Sunday. Who or what, if anything, guides and directs the spiritual experience in Unitarian practice? And at what point does diversity of spiritual experience diffuse into the Church of Latter-day Anarchy? A recent book published by one of my colleagues should give you a hint. Gives you an idea of the range and diversity of spiritual practice we espouse, as well as grounding it in everyday experience. So not an exhaustive list, but these are all spiritual practices that are written about in this book. What we could say, if we were being progressive, is that we're all about dissolving the barrier between the spiritual and the secular, which difference is, after all, a human construct, not a divine one, I don't think. The divine is in that game, when if it's not, why not? All, as Val says, all is spiritual, all is life. We'll give you a case study of how this might work out in practice. We do a Unitarian month of observance every year. We time it with Ramadan out of solidarity with our Muslim brothers. And as you know, Ramadan is a period where people are really focused on their spiritual life through the fasting and prayer aspects of it. Every time your stomach growls, you're reminded that this is my religion that's happening here. This is my spirituality that I'm honing here. So we've borrowed that idea, and if people want to fast, they can fast. But mainly the all spiritual practice, if you want to look at it from a material standpoint, is just about neuroplasticity. It is about carving new neural pathways in the brain where there were none before, and hopefully better ones. And so the intention, attention, repetition that goes into this is about creating new neural pathways. That's a great way to sell it to the hardcore rationalists in the room. And what we do is we give you freedom of specific choice. Freedom of specific choice of spiritual practice on a common theme. So the whole church will have a theme. We become what we do, really another name for neuroplasticity, the brain responds to repeated activities. And so I gave them like a list of 30 things that were just good for you to do. You know, fasting was included in them if they wanted to do that. Love yourself, these were specific practices aimed at self-care and self-compassion. Think thanks, obviously, was practices to do with recognizing, enumerating, noticing, and meditating on gratitudes in your life. And the most recent one, the moment to decide, is finding that holy pause between a stimulus and your response to it. So it's about confronting anger and hostility and peevishness and all that sort of thing. So we've taken these general themes, and I've given them, you know, not a prescriptive list, but like here's a bunch of suggestions, and some people will invent their own, you know, like I'm going to give up checking my Facebook all this month, and see what that does to my attention. That's great, yeah, good digital detox. That's fine. I would lose my mind probably. So we also give out a little bit of merch with the month of observance, a wristband that is worn. And I don't make people show, but I like badger them about, where's your wristband? Every Sunday for a month. And one of my congregants said, you know, when I'm doing this spiritual practice thing, and I'm at my desk, and I look down, I see my wristband, it's like getting a text from the minister going, how are you doing your practice? So I can be there without being there. So these are like 20 cents a piece, and you mass produce 100 of them or so. So this is a little mnemonic device to remind them. We tried stickers and badges. It doesn't work as well as a silicone wristband, because you don't have to take it off in the shower. It's always there. And the kids love to collect them, which is strange. I mean, the whole Sunday club full of 10, 12 kids, all with sort of four different colored wristbands. Collect the whole set, kids, like trading cards. Hey? What's written is the hashtag theme of the week, and at SA Unitarians, our Twitter site. And what I do is encourage people to share. So they're out in their daily lives, you know, between services and church activities, doing this thing they say they've committed to, or being reminded of it, you know, when their attention flags. And when we meet again in worship, we decentralize, so there's no preaching that week, really, maybe just a little, and ask people to share how it's going. You know, I hold the mic. Never turn the mic over. Never give the mic to a Unitarian. Never give that. So we'll get people to share. Struggles? Is it working for you? No, why not? What's happening? You've had a little breakthrough. That's great. Tell us about it. You haven't been keeping up with your practice. How do you feel about that? Tell me about the resistance. You know? So get people to share their experiences. So we're bringing secular life into the church, and having the church go out into secular life a bit as well. We'll have people put posts on the Facebook or on the Twitter account and so on saying, I've successfully done X today because my church is doing, and then I'll add the hashtag. So everybody who plugs into Twitter can read the hashtag and what we're doing on the hashtag. So this is an example of a diverse experience, and in church we try to celebrate and encourage and support. And that's, you know, where perhaps a little bit of preaching comes in. We'll sing about it, you know, we'll find an appropriate hymn and that sort of thing. So all of this embodying those three qualities again that I think are characteristic of our spirituality. Pluralism, do it however you want. There's a million ways to skin this particular cat. Generosity, make offers, accept offers, or don't. You know, it's really all about volition and an imaginative engagement with things. How am I going to bring this into my actual life? You know, how am I going to creatively engage with this? So, intention, the intention here. Remember, all good teaching, intention, attention, repetition. The intention is to disrupt their lives for 1 month a year, to disrupt the normal patterns, the normal neural pathways that we, you know, follow like, you know, little robots, to disrupt those, to direct their attention on the practice, both on Sundays and generally on the media and so on, and repetition, and keep doing it, in a celebratory, supportive context. So that's the month of observance. It's one application of our spirituality. What can we generalize about all this? Maybe four things we can generalize about all this. And I know that generalizations only exist in the mind of an idiot, said William Blake, but that's a generalization, so by his own definition, he's an idiot. Well, we start, obviously, with freedom of the pulpit and the pew. And that's, again, perhaps our most sacred ecclesiological tradition about how we run things. What gives direction to the diversity this freedom produces, or at least a place to start, is with our own individual experience. Our own individual experience, everyday concrete experiences of wholeness, grace, insight, consolation, inspiration, whatever lifts you, whatever works for you. And we work to make meaning upward from that. So it's an inductive approach, beginning with experience and trying to look up and out with it. It's not deductive. We can say that the Unitarian approach to spirituality is inductive rather than deductive. Now, epistemologically, this means it proceeds from experience we can know and be sure of. I know what I feel. I know what lights me up. I know what gives me life and spirit and grace and helps me live more abundantly. We start with that and we work up and out to find connection with other wisdom from whatever sources seem to bear out and affirm that experience, be it scripture or art or science or the wisdom of traditional cultures or whatever. We do not start, and this is perhaps one of our key differences, we do not start with the word and work down to experience from the word. The word is, after all, a record of somebody else's experience, we think. And we do not work deductively down to see how that word might play out in our experience, like thought for the day, which always manages to shoehorn Jesus into it somehow. We simply approach matters of the spirit rather conservatively, really, if you think about it, from the other end of that telescope. So our members may not know sophisticated theories of God or cosmology, but everybody, every human knows what they feel. Every human knows what feeds them, what nourishes them, what lights them up. Fortunately, there is scripture that affirms this from the Kalama Sutta, which says, don't go by reports, don't go by legends, by traditions, by scripture, by logical conjecture, by analogies, by agreement with pondering views or probability or the thought, this contemplative is our teacher. When you know for yourself that these qualities are skillful, these qualities are blameless, these qualities are praised by the wise, these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to welfare and to happiness, only then should you enter and remain in them. That's kind of us. So we take seriously the notion that we are all theologians. We take seriously the notion we are all theologians. It's just that most people are amateur theologians, and that's okay. In fact, that has to be okay. It can't be just the preserve of professionals. The same way that sport can't be the preserve of the elite athlete. The test of truth for Unitarians is experience, induction, and it's pragmatic. What gives me life and gives it more abundantly when we're at our best? Pragmatic and inductive. We are, of course, and this is us when we're at our best, we are, of course, just like Christians, not always at our best. Freedom in the wrong hands, the damaged, the desperate, the sociopathic, the immature, can easily become license. Liberty can morph into license in the wrong hands. More occasionally than we would care to admit, our approach to spirituality makes us functionally ungovernable. Is that disruption, or is that just the work? And my feeling as a minister is that's the work. That's the work. The problem for a free approach to spirituality Unitarianism offers is not, it's the opposite of indoctrination into core beliefs, texts, or people, but lacking a doctrinal center, our problem is drift at the edges. Prevents our growth and can even fracture our congregations along ideological factional fault lines. Come on in. For instance, I'll give you a for instance, culturally, in the UK, I was trained in the UK and I was introduced to Unitarianism in the UK, not in America. There is a huge north-south divide in theology and practice in Unitarians in the UK. Mutually exclusive, although they are nominally within the same general assembly of churches. Churches in the north are a kind of Anglican light. All of the flavor, half of the calories. And none of the communion or creed stuff, but all of the guys in black suits with collars doing lectionary readings every Sunday. Indistinguishable from Anglicanism, apart from a couple of jettisons. And in the South, in the cosmopolitan Southeast, Unitarian churches are functionally indistinguishable from Sunday assembly. Yet they both call themselves Unitarian. In my own home church in Adelaide, the variety of spiritual inclinations that must be accommodated include quasi-Buddhism, liberal Christianity, paganism, liberation theology in social justice practice, bourgeois philanthropy as religion, and an absolutely general skepticism that seeks only to deconstruct. God and not God play every Sunday in my church at pitch and toss. And my own church has tacked over the years of my membership back and forth, God, no God, like a dinghy with the wind in its teeth. God, no God, God, no God. In our quest to lift up the worth and dignity of each individual's experience of the divine, maintaining a commitment to a mutually supportive spiritual community of people on individual paths itself is a spiritual practice. Community is a spiritual practice, and those things that tend to disrupt community are the front lines of that spiritual practice. At our best, Unitarians hold this up as a model for how we might rebind, which I think is the core meaning of religio, a fragmented world together, even non-Christians, on a larger scale. We are trying, therefore, to be spiritual and also religious. Both. Why I have to choose? Why I can't be both? The mantra when experiences differ is this. That's Francis David, the author of the Edict of Torta again. We need not think alike to love alike. That is easy to say, but it is hard when the differences are going deep. That's the work of the Spirit, too. Fragmentation, splitting, tension, ideological, theological differences, that's where the work is. So the Unitarian approach to spirituality is neither easy, which is, I think, what people think it is, and it is not without traps for the unwary. Nor does it automatically bring our best selves to the fore. Colleagues in the U.S. have, in a recent collection of challenging essays, which I recommend to you, confronted what has been called the Unitarian Trinity of Errors.
A Unitarian Trinity? Wait a minute.
Individualism, authoritarianism, anti-authoritarianism, and exceptionalism. Now it is easy to see how these can emerge from radical freedom and the epistemology of an inductive ground-up approach. You can see how these would emerge. Individuals striving pragmatically for what works for me constantly test the bonds of community where everyone else, too, is seeking what works for them. Anti-authoritarianism deconstructs even the Beatitudes, eats up ministries and spits them out like popcorn, and dethrones any God beyond the critical, needy ego. And exceptionalism, particularly in the U.S. context, because that the whole cultural framing, the U.S. exceptionalism, Unitarian exceptionalism. Exceptionalism lends an arrogance that elevates our creedlessness. We don't have core beliefs, man, as being the least sheep-like, the least deceived among churches. And this last one worries me the most. Because you don't have to be Carl Jung to know nobody's fool can also be nobody's savior. Hands up, who'd be a Unitarian minister? Why do I do it? Why do I do it? It's a reasonable question. Why would a reasonably intelligent, not especially self-destructive person who's old enough to know better, with other options, try to lead a community of individual spiritualities, a dynamic that keeps threatening to fly apart like wet cake in the rain? Well, it's not all bad. A richer reading of these errors is one that also constructs their opposite and offers certain promises. These errors can be flipped like a coin. The flip side of the trinity of errors, when we're at our worst, holds promises of what we can be at our best. That's a paradox, yes, but Frank Schaffer says paradox is a blessing. The flip side of rampant self-seeking individualism is pluralism, an acknowledgement that the mystery we call God, like the ball in the exercise, must and will be experienced differently by different people, and that is not some human error, and it is not original sin, but it's the plural, illimitable, fecund nature of the divine played out in his diverse creation. The flip side to our anti-authoritarianism, what we be free from, can point us to a shattering discovery of what we're free for, and unleash our generous hearts, enabling us to make offers of our gifts to others. And the answer to our exceptionalism is celebrating and using the creative imagination, not keeping the uniqueness of our various and varying lights under little bushels, but to make an unashamed virtue of producing continuously fresh approaches to the mystery. Mr. Plumer yesterday mentioned the Sanctuaries movement in D.C. That's a Unitarian effort. Reverend Eric Martinez, essentially, it's predicated on the creative imagination and creating an arts hub along certain social justice themes. They produce art, share art with the community, as a kind, and that's the spiritual practice of that particular place. It doesn't look or feel at all like church, but it's doing church in the world. Once upon a time, Unitarianism diverged from mainline Christianity, citing that the Trinity was both non-scriptural and counter to reason. A divided God can't be God, we said. You said, die, heretic scum. To quote the joke, I don't even know. Personally, look, I find that pedantry only serves the interests of professionals only. And everyone has to make a living, so, you know, go for your life. But I think it's past its use by date. And it's a waste of our energies that could be spent on cooperatively redeeming the actual physical world one person at a time. As you all know, this scholastic factionalism is one of the things that keeps the unchurched laity away in droves. Nothing attracts people more than some old scholars having a go at each other. Yeah, I want to see that. I'd rather do breakfast, bicycling, and bunnies any Sunday. No one out there, none of the people that come into my church struggling with an ever darker 21st century secular meaninglessness cares about this debate anymore. Nobody cares. There are bigger problems to confront. You know what they are. And they're going to require collaborations of collectives larger than just Christianity or Unitarianism alone. And for all our divergence over Christology, I don't see how perpetually finding differences between Christianity and Unitarianism is as spiritually nourishing or as necessary as finding connections. I don't see why anyone else would either. Apart from satisfying a reflexive tribalism, like different footy clubs, it's like Adelaide, one city, two clubs, like different footy clubs with members who are in fact neighbors, enmeshed by the same social, political, cultural, and cosmic forces, but just love to hate on each other because that's an easy outlet for despair about our general lack of powerlessness and efficacy. The point of the spiritual journey is not to prove we were right all along, or you were, but to redeem the aching world by supporting the journey of each person, one by one, wherever they start, which is how it only ever happens, not just through the collective membership of the tradition. So let me offer you this, olive laurel, the way a sportsman-like loser might offer honor and peace to a champion. You win. You were right. Plato was right. The Trinity is real. The Trinity is real. Godhead is triune, three things in one. So here's your Trinity back with a little topspin on it. God the Father is the fathering forth of a creation that's illimitably, incorrigibly plural. God the Son pours himself out into it generously, without loving it all, without exception. God the Holy Spirit is the fire of our human imagination with which we co-create with God his endless forms. So let's play ball together, forever, in peace. Thank you for playing along. I will now evade your questions.
I'm sure he will answer them beautifully.
So, I know.
We do have a reasonable amount of time, so.
45 minutes, that's pretty good.
It is.
15 minutes for Q&A. Or comments, I don't mind. So, you know, go for your life, really. That's what I'm here for.
Can you talk about your move from your original church to where you are?
I was raised Roman Catholic in working class Baltimore, quite like Dodd Butler Bass was. My parents were bog peasant Catholic, mumbled, drunk as the Lord Saturday night, mumbled over your big Sunday morning. I went to Catholic grade school with nuns, Catholic high school with Jesuit priests, and I went to seminary for a year and decided it wasn't for me. I was the second son, the idiot son who goes into clergy. I was in the army. Yeah. That makes it sound glib and fun, but in fact, my parents and I, obviously, it took decades to get back to the sort of mutual acceptance of where we were spiritually, and I couldn't study for Unitarian ministry until they were in the ground, because it would have killed them. It really would have killed them. It would have killed them dead. I mean, when my second daughter was born, before my wife and I actually married, and my mother had the bishop say a novena for my soul. So I mean, we're talking that kind of cultural Catholicism. So understandably, my Unitarianism is a coming to terms with that. All and that, what you can't escape the past. Scott Fitzgerald. We row on, boats beating against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. When I first walked into a Unitarian church, the first thing anybody said, and this is in Richmond in London, somebody said, for me, religion's always been largely a matter of metaphor. And no one had suggested that to me, not even the Jesuits, who were not stupid. But that just blew my mind open. I kept coming back. And my attachment to it, I guess, given my nature, is primarily cerebral and has had to become more embodied experiential. But it's not been easy. It wasn't easy to leave, particularly seminary. I had to go to my confessor and say, look, I just don't think this is for me. To be frank, a life of celibacy did not appeal to a 19-year-old person. Yes, ma'am.
Very mundane. Unitarian Universalism. I've always heard them called Unitarians. And the tacking on the Universalism, I've only seen very recently.
The merger that happened.
Two different things that have amalgamated?
It's a U.S. iteration of Unitarianism. There's the Unitarian Church, Universalist Church. In the 60s, they decided that they had much more in common than differences. Universalism, the doctrine of universal salvation, which was not antithetical to the Unitarian approach. So they merged and became Unitarian Universalism, which has got to be the most theologically heavy word salad. Think about it. Our name bespeaks a theological orientation, yet we have no set theology. Paradox. Again. So that my own church in Adelaide was a colonial project of British Unitarianism. However, over the years, and American ministers have come over, we've since become members of the UUA as well as the British Unitarians. And have formed in the 1980s Australian New Zealand Unitarian group called ANZUA, which incorporates
the Universalist, Unitarian Universalist name, ideas to be as inclusive as possible with that. So that might answer your question. Yeah.
I presume that Universalism, that one, is also one of those things that sprung up in America in the late 1800s.
Yeah. I mean, and had a... It shared tap roots with like the early Reformation, Michael Servetus and early Reformation stuff. But again, what it seems to hold for, and what we're getting is largely unchurched people, and there are a lot of them in Australia, that want some sort of ritual, but that really don't want to know much about the history of the Reformation and how we came out. I mean, surprisingly, it really is for specialists. And so I try not to...
Australia's not like history.
No, well, as a frontier country.
We don't do history.
Anyway, Unitarianism in the UK, Unitarian Universalism in the US, in Australia, we'll take what we get. Next question.
You just mentioned subtitle.
So if you know, to follow up, it's okay.
Well, you just, the word salvation, like, sick you from telling at some stage. Can you define what you mean by salvation? Is that a...
Well, there's no original sin.
That's a
response to how we diverge from the Baptists. You know, lot come with Anabaptists. We have the minister in Bury in the north of England who is a Unitarian Anabaptist. We don't believe that we're born in sin. We don't think that's a constructive way to look at ourselves. And we can have, scriptural arguments about it, but suppose you just put scripture back on the shelf with all the other sacred texts in the world and see it in some sort of balance, rather than only predicate what your theology is off that one thing. You had a question.
Thanks, Rob. Really, really interesting. You mentioned a number of things that sort of come together for me. You said contemplation, you just said original blessing. You used spiritual practices that are daily, that are sort of secular things, but also for rituals and so forth. I run retreats and around the Parker Palmer model from the Quakers.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Where does you're obviously drawing from a range of different traditions and that, and bringing them together. Is that the case? And is it a contemplative kind of model? I'm not talking about Catholic contemplative here. I'm talking about sort of a modern. Almost mindfulness, I suppose. I don't want to use that word because it's an industry.
Yeah, it is.
I want to stay with sort of the contemplative around Parker Pang model. But is that, how does that fit with what you've just been saying?
Those are very good observations and very good question. And just for the record, my own congregation in Adelaide have played catch with the local Quaker meetings. So if someone's pissed off at the Quaker secretary, they come to us for a few years until the Quaker secretary changes. If someone doesn't like the minister at the Unitarian Church, they go to the Quakers, and so on. There's a tennis match going on. So is it a contemplative practice? Yes. It's still finding its feet. We're still talking about new models of worship. We're still, in my own church, is deeply middle class and conservative in its own way, but I mean, a lot less so now because I just get bashing against it. In that, the center of gravity of the service of worship is the sermon, which we don't call a sermon because that has negative connotations. We call it an address because I'm talking to you. What is that a contemplative practice? My background as an academic was in communication, and pitched correctly and managed skillfully, a good address can be a contemplative practice. Taking people on a journey with you, the rise and fall of your voice, and the actor's vocal magic that keeps people moving with you through time and through mental space. But we're trying to diversify. For example, we have a mindfulness group that has been set up with my blessing. They meet Thursday nights and they do a kind of sangha meditation thing. And I'm starting essentially a Lectio Divina as an alternative to the traditional worship. And the actual Lectio Divina is drawn from our own breviary. So I've crowdsourced What's the one reading you keep coming back to all your life for inspiration, consolation, and enlightenment? And I've collected, you know, 150 of these in this volume. Just pull one out, and that's the reading for the day. Read it, music, meditation, read again, music, meditation, read again to deepen, maybe go for a walk, come back. Everybody speaks to it that wants to, from their own experience, limited time. Nobody addresses anything anybody else says. There's no crosstalk. And no response. It's just what that brought up for you. So I'm trying to institute that in the new year. I'm first taking a couple of months long service leave in October and November to catch my breath. So is it a contemplative practice? It can be. Generally speaking, it at its worst, it's an improving public talk in the Victorian model bounded by a couple of hymns. At its worst, it's, here's an interesting thing. Here's an interesting thing. Why don't you come Sunday morning when you're hungover and listen to this interesting thing? Why would you do that in an information age? We have to be able to offer them more than information. We have to be able to offer them more than just new ideas. We have to offer them an experience that's worth getting up on a Sunday morning for, and avoiding the Bunnings biking and breakfast thing. And I'm finding that no matter how good I make an address, and honest to God, I can make them good. As good as I can make that, I don't think it's enough. We got to find another way to be together in a more egalitarian sense. Obviously, the end game of Unitarian ministry is to make yourself redundant. To make these people so spiritually switched on that they can do it for themselves. If there's autonomy, there's freedom. If there's freedom, there's God.
Thank you.
Have
you said, and I came in late, sorry,
but
community is a spiritual
practice. Yeah.
So that the idea of community exists and has to continue, so that when you say you want your congregation to be self-sustaining or something, I mean, but we're still talking about the membership.
Oh yeah, I don't want them flying off in all directions like like a supernova. Necessarily, I'll have to think about that a little bit. Maybe I do. Initially, my gut response is no. For me, it's the difference between religious and spiritual has to do with community, how we bind together, our social, relational. All virtue is social, so it's how we are together, and that is better than who I am alone. And as you know. As you all know, there is an epidemic of loneliness in the 21st century world. It is, our devices have not made better, but made worse. And what people are finding when we do this right, with the right music and the right spirit and the right welcome and the right vibe in the room, and enough people in the congregation lifted up to feel like they can give back, we do have something like a cohesive community of individuals, a herd of cats. the paddock is really big, but just I when I came to Australia in 99, I'd only been going to Unitarian services for about 6 years, and when I came to the strange town of Adelaide, because I was married to an Adelaidean, I thought, oh good, there's Unitarian church, ready-made community, which cheapens it a little. But at the same time, it's not a bad place to start. I mean, recognizing that need in me, not to be this, you know, adventurous lone wolf going off and just growing where I'm planted, but recognizing that wherever you're planted, you're drawing from the environment around you. So you might as well choose the good soil. I've had other jobs. This is the hardest thing I've ever done, without a shadow of doubt. I've taught in difficult schools. I've taught impossible courses at university. I've performed in front of thousands in very difficult things with a lot of money at stake. This is the hardest thing ever. Keeping each individual worth alive, no matter how broken or fragmented and difficult it is, and keeping the community supporting their differentness, that's hard. And I think it's got a shelf life in terms of my own efficacy at it before it starts becoming all about me. So I'm giving myself another 5 years and then I have to find something else to do.
Do you find that the Edict of Tirada protects you from the slings and arrows of discontent in the way that it's meant to?
It's easy, I mean, in a way. It's a rare year where I don't have to pull that one out of my back pocket and go, freedom of the pulpit, freedom of the pew, man.
Yeah.
You don't like it, you don't like it so bad, write a letter to the committee, have me sacked, good luck. You need 75% of the congregation. Go your hardest. Or you could just treat it like a TV program you didn't like particularly. Next. You know. It's astonishing because we deal with people's real deep core values and, you know, really where they live. People can get mightily offended by the things you offer sometimes. Deeply, deeply, deeply hurt by it. And you got to be really careful. But at the same time, I got to preach it like I feel it. What else am I going to do? Walk through it like a minefield? So, no, it doesn't really protect you, but it is a useful one to pull out. Once a year, the Edict of Tordo will find its way into the address schedule. Think how radical an idea that is, people. If they like it, well, if not, none shall compel them. You are not compelled to take anything I say seriously. Why should I come? Why indeed?
Well, can I make a point? Yep. I tended to say to the congregation, the last thing you would want is for me to stand up and say something I don't believe.
True, right. True, right.
And most often there's nods of approval, you know, in there.
You are, how many of you are from Brisbane? Okay. Well, the good news is there is a fellowship in Brisbane if you want to go and check it out, which is led by the incredible Renee Hill and his husband James. It is the most functional, spiritually healthy fellowship that is no minister, but, you know, a community collective of people doing this kind of practice. That I just, you know, there are cards on the table. Take one. Contact Renee. Go and see it for yourself. They do a great job. And if I were living in Brisbane, I'd go there. Any other questions?
The Spirit of Life is Sydney. One of two in Sydney.
Yes, you have two now.
Yes, I know, and that's a long story.
Yeah, it's one of those factional things.
Yeah.
The only reason that I'm the only full-time paid minister in Australia and New Zealand.
Australia, yes.
We have a half-time minister in Auckland, but I'm in. And the reason is
and who is here?
Who is here? Clay's here.
Clay Neal.
Yeah. The only reason that these congregations still have anything like a ministry is that they've managed their money well over 160 years. That's it. There was enough prudence and also enough kind of top-down power from old families to make sure that things didn't fall apart. But they can easily. There's two fellowships in Melbourne now.
Yes.
Two in Sydney. Really, there's two in Adelaide, and the Shady Grove is our little satellite settlers' chapel on 2 acres or 3 acres of unspoiled bushland in the Adelaide Hills, hand-built by a couple of nutty Mancunian Unitarians who were street preachers and bought farms over there. And there's no electricity, and we have a service there once a month, Vespers in the evening, before the light gets too dark and they light candles. There's a small clutch of people around there that sort of look after that and have their regular worship there, but they're still part of the body of the Church Incorporated. But I'd be interested to see, there's probably a PhD in like coming up with the number of all the Unitarian Universalist churches in the world and how many of those are a result of a split rather than seeding, you know. These have been planted so much as rhizomatically separate. Anyway, Liz, thank you for your attention, and I'll see you at the rest of the conference. Thank you.
Please join me.
Thank you for your...
Rob McPherson's addresses are his intellectual property. They may only be used by other preachers if his permission is sought and expressed, acknowledgement is given that they are his work, and the addresses are used in their entirety. To seek his permission, email Rob at unitarianSA@bigpond.com.
That's our episode of Expanding Horizons for the week. The introduction is a piece named Elements by the artist CDK. The piece is licensed under Creative Commons. This is White Rabbit, out.